This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We've long heard that necessity is the mother of invention, but what about play? Our guest today says its contributions are hugely undervalued, arguing that if you did a paternity test on many of our most important ideas or institutions, you will find, invariably, that leisure and play were involved. This hour on The Exchange, we're talking with author Stephen Johnson about his latest book, Wonderland, How Play Made the Modern World. In it, Johnson describes many examples of how one person's quest for delight ended up transforming the world. We're exploring Wonderland today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Stephen Johnson joins us from Boston. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, let's just grab that whole theme, Stephen. You know, that play is way, way more important than most people realize, myself included. Why is play, in your opinion, Stephen, undervalued?
Well, if you think about what you learned, you know, in high school or in college as the kind of driving forces of history, right? You kind of do the list in your head, right? You'd say, well, the quest for power or the struggle for freedom or liberty or the just basic survival or kind of military conquest or religious belief or tribalism or nationalism in various forms. You know, we've got a list of probably six or seven broad forces that we've conventionally been told are kind of driving historical change and for better and for worse, you know, in the service of progress and sometimes not. But rarely on that list is this kind of broad category, which I call in the subtitle play, but encompasses a bunch of different things. But it's basically things that people did for the fun of it, that did not have kind of survival value, that did not have a strict utilitarian value, but were just interesting and fun and delightful and playful. And it turns out when you gather all those things together and look at them as a kind of single category, as a group, they actually have had a tremendous impact on life, not just in terms of the time we spent, which increasingly we have more and more time for play in the modern world, but also these playful pursuits ended up triggering momentous changes in kind of serious history and scientific breakthroughs and political revolutions and broad changes in society. And so it's kind of this forgotten kind of side of history that we don't take seriously enough. So Wonderland, an attempt to kind of tell that story in one kind of coherent package.
Well, and there are a gazillion examples, and it is eye-opening to see how often, you know, play, fun, entertainment, the quest for what you call delight, you know, maybe it's beautiful clothing or delicious food, has led to these amazing innovations and shifts in society. I just wonder, Stephen, how you first started noodling on this idea that play was really, really important.
Well, this came out of the kind of structure of the book came out of how we got to now, the last book I did, which was also the PBS series. And how we got to now is also kind of a history of innovations that changed the world. I kind of picked six objects, in a sense, for that book that we now take for granted. We don't even think of them as innovations anymore. So that book and that series had a chapter and an episode about glass, for instance, or electric light, and kind of told the 500-year history or sometimes 2,000-year history of where this idea came from and all the crazy people who invented these things and the consequences of their inventions. And that is a very satisfying and fun format and topic as a researcher and a writer for me personally. And so I could write 20 books in that series. There's so many things that you could kind of analyze. So I was interested in doing something in that mode again, but I wanted to have a kind of a macro argument, actually, beyond just the the individual stories of these innovations. And I'd been interested in the connection between play and creativity for a really long time. I'd written a book many years ago called Everything Bad is Good for You that was kind of defending video games. And
Everything Bad is Good for You. I think I heard about that book.
Yeah. And then even as far back as my grad school years, I was an English lit student at Columbia, and I had studied the kind of the rise of the department stores in Paris in the 19th century, and the connection between kind of the fashion industry and the creative industry, and so I had just a whole host of kind of separate anecdotes that I'd stumbled across over the course of my career. And suddenly I thought, well, wait, I can put this all together. And I think if you look at them all together, there's an argument for the centrality of play here. But it was a bit of a hunch. And then I started researching and diving into all these things, and I became more and more convinced that there's a really important point to be made here.
How do you define play, Stephen? I mean, how is it different, for example, sitting down for a game of chess versus going out and kicking a ball around the backyard?
Yeah, I have a broad definition. For sure, as I kind of said, it's like all the things that you do for fun,
yeah,
that do not have some kind of functional value. So it includes, you know, listening to music. It includes playing chess. It includes, you know, fashion. You know, so you need clothes, right? You need to have some kind of garment, particularly in Boston in the winter. You need to keep yourself warm with some kind of covering. That's functional, but you don't need it to be a brilliant shade of purple, right? That is not functional. And yet human beings, for an immensely long period of time, have been fascinated with and, you know, intrigued by and driven towards those extra kind of playful layers to things, whether it's the taste of spices in the early days of really the first global economy, global marketplace came out of the taste for spice. And spice was not nutritional. It was just an interesting flavor that made food more fun, all the way to fashion and to gameplay, things that are not actually essential to our existence, but that we nonetheless get a great deal of delight out of. That's the definition of play that I'm working with.
So we could all wrap ourselves in burlap bags and eat unsalted potatoes, and, you know, we'd survive. But there's this quest for delight and taste and entertainment and newness, right, Stephen? I mean, the brain wants something new.
Yeah, that's one of the things I read about at the end of the book, which is trying to figure out why play has driven so many innovations, and we can talk about some examples of that. But our brains have a deep-seated wiring to be interested in and focus on novelty of some kind, of surprise. I talk about it in the book as the surprise instinct. When you see something that confounds your expectations, you pay attention. I mean, you know, 6-week-old babies will do this. All the things that I write about in the book, one of the things that unites them all is that when they first appeared, they were surprising. They were new. That was a new flavor. That was a new fabric. That was a new color. That was a new game. And that draws our brains in and makes us focus and pay attention. But it also, it's a constantly moving goalpost, right? Because one generation's surprise is the next generation's, you know, old news, right? And so you have to keep updating the whatever form of delight you're talking about to make it interesting. And that forces you to innovate. It forces you to come up with new ideas, new twists, and new technologies. And so that outward kind of push, that almost exploratory side of the surprise instinct, is one of the reasons why it's been such a driver of new ideas in society.
Do some types of play, Stephen, and again, defining play broadly as you do, you know, whether it's the quest for delight, for things that are lovely or delicious or just fun, do some types of play tend more often to lead to innovation than others?
It's a really good question. I think in the six kind of fields that I look at in the book, they look at fashion and shopping and games and illusion and spices and so on. I would say all of them are equally innovative. They're just innovative in different ways.
Sure.
So, for instance, the last chapter is all about play spaces, basically leisure spaces specifically engineered to create a kind of an envelope of relaxation or or enjoyment. And you think about how many of those exist in the world today, right? I mean, we're just surrounded with movie theaters and amusement parks and zoos and coffee houses and bars and, you know, I mean, just shopping malls. It's just a massive explosion of these things all around, most of which didn't exist, certainly in the sheer kind of diversity and number of them just a few hundred years ago. But those kinds of spaces have actually driven not so much technological innovation, but really political innovation. If you look at the history, for instance, of bars and taverns, which is really kind of the original play space, it's probably the oldest form of, you know, kind of a building or a room that's engineered to kind of hang out, that's not work, not home, that where you go there and you have a couple of drinks and you hang out. The history of taverns, I mean, here I am, I'm talking to you from Boston, right? I mean, you can't tell the history of the American Revolution without the tavern culture of New England. I mean, that was the central kind of information sharing node in the network of the revolutionaries during that period. It was a space where people would gather and talk about their grievances, where they would read the Declaration of Independence out loud, where they would read Common Sense out loud. And it's possible that the American Revolution would have happened had taverns not been invented. but
it sure helped.
it would have required a different kind of information network, for it would have unfolded in a really different way. It was really dependent on the tavern. And so those kinds of spaces have been crucial. Coffee houses have a similar kind of role in Europe and London in particular for kind of the spread of new ideas. And those spaces are, you know, a really, and I'm just thinking about the gay rights movement, right? I mean, gay bars were an essential part of building some kind of critical mass for that kind of social and political movement. So it's a big part of kind of political, propelling political ideas into the world as well as technological ones.
Well, Stephen, here's an email from Bob in Dover who says, play is instrumental in everybody's lives. As the owner of a toy store in Portsmouth, I see it on a daily basis. Bob says children explore and begin to understand their world through play, both by themselves and with others. Their parents respond to things that they remember from their own childhoods. Bob says there seems to be a gut emotion when you think back on the times you played and those things you played with. Play sparks creativity and confidence. Finally, Bob quotes Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, that play is the real work of childhood. Bob, what a great email, especially since you run a toy store. Thank you so much. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, that's terrific. I mean, I start the book with this quote from Charles Eames that's, toys and games are the prelude to serious ideas, which is a similar kind of idea that we start in this playful state, and that exploratory state of play then leads to kind of bigger ideas that we take more seriously. But if you don't have that initial kind of playful state, you don't get anywhere. And actually, the book, right after that quote, it opens up with this very, very important place in history that I think most people don't know about in Baghdad, at the height of the Islamic Golden Age. There was this institution called the House of Wisdom, which I always thought was a great name. And the House of Wisdom was kind of a mix between a think tank and a translation bureau, but also kind of a maker lab. And there were all these brilliant engineers in there, and a couple of them, there were these brothers, Banu Musa, and they created all these extraordinary feats of engineering that they documented in a couple of books with very elaborate schematics, beautifully designed books, actually, that are reproduced in Wonderland. And they had these engineering breakthroughs and marvels that would not be seen in Western Europe for another 400 or 500 years, incredibly accurate clocks and hydraulic systems and these different kinds of valves and things like that would go on to become breakthrough ideas in engineering. But if you look at their diagrams, everything they built was basically a toy. They were all just these little playthings. You know, it was a little robot drummer boy and a peacock that would dispense a little thing of soap and a clock that was in the shape of an elephant. I mean, they were all amusements and follies. But hidden inside them were these revolutionary ideas in engineering.
Yeah, the beginnings of the modern computer, really.
Yeah. The other thing that they did that that is in the music chapter is they invented this automated, basically an automated kind of flute player, but it was what made it, it was kind of like a music box, and it had a little cylinder that you could encode information about the song you wanted it to play on this little rotating cylinder with little pins on it that corresponded to each note. And they called this thing the instrument that plays itself. And it was really one of the most important machines invented anywhere in the world in that period, because what made it so radical is that it you could swap out that cylinder. If you wanted it to play a different song, you could put you could create a new cylinder and put it in and encode it with, you know, the notes you wanted to play. And this meant that it was really the first programmable machine
right.
that had ever been invented.
And how long ago was that, Stephen?
That was like 1,200 years ago.
That's amazing.
And, well, and really, that that's the beginning of the idea of kind of hardware and software.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of imaginable with that device at that point.
Bob, thank you for the email. You can email us as well, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Stephen, let's go to John in Sandwich. Hi, John. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I have a longtime favorite quote from a book called Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins about neoteny. And it's neoteny is remaining young. And it may be ironic that it is so little known because human evolution has been dominated by it. Humans have evolved to their relatively high state by retaining the immature characteristics of their ancestors. Behavioral traits such as curiosity about the world, flexibility of response, and playfulness are common to practically all young mammals, but are usually rapidly lost with the onset of maturity in all but humans.
Wow. Yeah. John, what's the word again, please?
Neoteny. N-E-O-T-E-N-Y.
Wow. Okay. So go ahead.
Okay. Almost finished. Humanity has advanced when it has advanced, not because it has been sober, responsible, and cautious, but because it has been playful, rebellious, and immature.
Wow. John, thank you so much for the call. Stephen, neoteny, what do you think?
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, it's interesting. I didn't explore this quite that much in the book, although I actually we talked about it a little bit in one of the episodes of the podcast that we did. You can actually kind of divide up the mammals in terms of how long their childhoods are and how much time they spend engaging in playful behavior during those childhoods. And there's a very clear correlation between the length of that kind of playtime in early childhood and the ultimate kind of flexible, adaptive thinking that that organism is capable of doing. And it seems as if play, in part because of its connection to surprise, which we already talked about, if you want to just kind of pre-program a creature to just, you know, have a prediction about the world that is invariant and one response, one strategy for dealing with the world, you don't need play. But if you want a creature that is going to be able to respond intelligently to changing circumstances, unanticipated circumstances, and adapt and invent new solutions on the fly, play is the way that you train that organism's brain to be responsive to that unpredictable future. And human beings happen to have this incredibly long kind of playful state, and they keep a lot of those, you know, allegedly immature characteristics, as the caller says, into adulthood. So it's a very important part of who we are as a species, not just our kind of cultural history.
Wow, that's super interesting. And people often think of, you know, dolphins as playful and also intelligent versus other animals who seem to leave that playfulness behind as they mature. Thank you so much for the call, John. More of your comments in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Everyone says necessity is the mother of invention, but our guest says there's a huge connection between play, fun, entertainment, and innovation. We're talking with Stephen Johnson. He's author of the new book Wonderland and the podcast Wonderland. Stephen's also author of 9 other books on history, creativity, and innovative thinking, and he's the host of the PBS series How We Got to Now. Give us your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. What have you seen in terms of this connection between play and entertainment and innovation? Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. You know, Stephen, we should talk a little bit about the expansion of leisure time and disposable income because, you know, on the face of it, you think, all right, well, this is all well and good for people who have time and money. But for somebody who's just scraping by, how can they engage in play that leads to innovation?
Well, it's actually one of the interesting kind of patterns in the book, if you look at it over the historical kind of sweep of things. A lot of the, when I go back and look at the kind of origins of a lot of these customs or experiences, they are the participants in them in their kind of early days are, you know, the elite. They're the well-to-do, the folks who have a lot of money and have spare time for this and leisure time for this. But a major part of the story is how democratizing these forces end up being, and how, you know, it was very unusual to be entertained by, say, a little automated device, you know, in France in the 1700s. There were these automatons that were, you know, basically little kind of mechanical robots. And it was only the kind of aristocracy that would go and look at these miraculous little devices that kind of descend from the stuff that was being devised in Baghdad at the House of Wisdom. But, you know, now we have, you know, all kinds of entertainment that are cheap and available. And it's not at all anymore just a kind of aristocratic experience.
So it starts with the wealthy and the leisure class.
This is one case where there is a kind of a trickling down. But the other thing I'd point out, and this is really important, this is important to the politics side of this, which is that a lot of these developments had a democratizing force in a broader sense. So, for instance, I have a chapter about illusion, kind of optical illusions and magic and things like that. And there are these amazing illusion shows that were in European cities and some American cities in the late 1700s, early 1800s. If you went to London's West End in 1810, there would have been dozens and dozens of these shows, some of them like the Phantasmagoria, which was kind of almost like a haunted house with magic lantern displays and things like that, or the Panorama, which was a 360-degree painting that the word panorama actually was coined to describe this particular exhibition. Or they would have these mechanical reproductions of great military battles, or you would go and look at, you know, these automatons, kind of mechanical dolls dancing or performing. I mean, there are a million variations of these, all of them based on different technologies, which is kind of interesting. And they all end up getting wiped out by the movies.
Right. Like, I was going to say, we're leading up to cinema, right?
Everything, they all disappear. You had this beautiful diversity of different kinds of immersive illusion, and they all just get wiped out by the cinema. But what made those spaces really interesting is that it was one of the few places where the kind of middle class, you wouldn't have, you know, the working poor in those spaces because they did cost a little bit of money, but you would have kind of middle class people coming and hanging out with, you know, upper middle class folks, and then with full on aristocracy and even the king and queen would go to these exhibits. They were so fascinating that they would go and say, "Oh, the panorama, we need to have a special showing of this." Of course, they would go kind of see it separately. But you had a shared kind of cultural experience that was really, for the first time, available, other than, you know, say the church, was available to different parts of society, and where they would literally be kind of sharing the room in some cases. And so it was a force for kind of democratic culture that crept into the kind of society through the guise of entertainment and frivolity and leisure, but it actually had a very powerful political kind of effect.
You know, we should, before we go too much further, Stephen, we really should talk about, you know, this search for desire for delightful things, taste, beautiful clothes, whatever. All these, you know, you hear play leads to innovation and so forth, and you think, wow, that's great. But you are very careful to point out it's not always great.
Yeah.
For example, yeah. You know, people's desire for spices, pepper and nutmeg and so forth, led to some terrible exploitation of people in the South Pacific Sea. So just kind of connect those dots for us, please.
Yeah, it is important to point this out. It's a very kind of happy and upbeat subject matter, but the real argument is that play and delight changed the world, and in some cases it changed the world for better, some cases it led to intense human suffering. As you say, the spice trade led to great advances in connecting the world, but it also led to some of the most obscene passages of exploitation and slavery in history. The other one that is actually so relevant to today, because it's all about globalization, is the story of calico and chintz, the cotton fabrics that first came to Europe from India. And in the late 1600s, particularly in London, all these well-to-do women got obsessed with this new exotic fabric that had these beautiful patterns that would survive being washed multiple times, which was a breakthrough. Most fabrics didn't have that property. And also it was soft, it was cotton, and so it felt a lot better. At that point, you know, a lot of people were wearing wool underwear, which was
not very comfortable.
In rainy, cold London was really not pleasant at all. So suddenly you had these beautiful kind of sensual fabrics, and there was this explosion of interest in them, and it meant that the East India Company made a huge amount of money importing it. There was this huge trade imbalance with India, but it also triggered this political backlash because it was devastating to the traditional British wool industry. And there was this kind of, you know, what you might call a make England's wool industry great again kind of movement that went against all these women who were buying these delightful fabrics from across the world, and they were shamed as calico madams, and there were all these pamphlets written against them, and it was a major kind of political upheaval. And for a while, actually, calico and chintz were banned from England. But of course, at the same time, a number of engineers and inventors and entrepreneurs began to think, well, wait a second, maybe we could manufacture cotton using some kind of automated machinery here in England, and that became the Industrial Revolution. So the Industrial Revolution really comes out of this taste for, this, you know, intrigue with calico and chintz. But now that leads to a lot of things. It creates a great economic engine in England. It leads to all of the problems with the factory system, of course, and the kind of working class suffering of that period. But of course, it also then, the market for cotton plays a huge role in extending the life of slavery in the United States, right? I mean, just think about how important cotton was to the history of slavery. So it's a very complicated thing where you have to look at something like cotton. When those women were sitting there in 1680 kind of thinking about how wonderful this new fabric was, you know, on the one hand, they were about to set in motion a chain of events that would create the Industrial Revolution, which, you know, is probably the most important technological change in the history of the world. And at the same time, they were about to set in motion a chain of events that would lead to, you know, 50, arguably 50 extra years of slavery in the South, because the South became so dependent on the economy of cotton.
And
so
the Civil War and all the people who died in
the Civil War. I mean,
war.
Just think of all the, you know, we're still living with the kind of echoes of these things. And it begins in a very real way with people saying, "Ooh, I love how beautiful this fabric is."
Well, we talked earlier about spices, and here's an email that came in from Anne in Hanover. And thank you, Anne. She says, many would take issue with her guest's idea that spices are about novelty and play, me included. Anne says spices and herbs have medicinal value. Curcumin, the spice that makes curry yellow, has anti-cancer and anti-inflammatory effects, as does ginger root. Garlic is an antimicrobial, and yes, they flavor our food. And thank you so much for the email. And you do talk about this in the book, Stephen.
Yeah, it was okay. So there are two different things. There are some medicinal uses that have been discovered in some of these things that we consider to be spices. At the time, people did not really recognize those particular uses because they didn't have a scientific method to identify those uses. They didn't have randomized controlled trials to figure out what they were good for or what they weren't good for. But it is true that they were considered in part medicinal, and so there was a perceived functional value to the spices. But there was also just as important, if not more important, a very deep-seated sense that people were kind of tasting the exotic. Basically, they were tasting other parts of the world, and there was this almost religious belief that these other parts of the world that, you know, imagine, you know, up until late 1700s, every single clove, for instance, in the world came from one of five islands, you know, near Indonesia, the spice island. So you were getting these flavors from these exotic spaces around the world that you couldn't even imagine going to, you couldn't see images of, but you could taste in some way. And so there was this sense of connection to some other almost Eden-like, kind of Garden of Eden-like place. And that was a huge part of the appeal. Now, they did, over time, they did become associated with medicine, and that was one of the reasons why they became so valuable, but it was only part of the story.
Well, Ann, thank you very much for the email. Let's go back to the phones. Peter's calling in from Concord. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. How
morning.
Are you?
Fine.
Excellent. Now, this is a great topic. I'm an electrical engineer and patent attorney, and I've definitely seen the relationship between play, maintaining your peace, and innovation. I have a lot of clients in Israel as well. And, I mean, when you look at companies like Google and Dyn, which was just acquired by Oracle, you've got an environment that basically is provided to maintain people's peace, to decrease stress. And by decreasing stress, you increase innovation, because when you're in a stressful environment, as everybody knows, you're so preoccupied with one thing only that you can't absorb your environment, you can't think openly, and you, by that manner, you can't produce in a productive manner. But when you're in a playful environment, the stress literally decreases, your vision opens, you're able to absorb by many different means, and creativity comes out. I mean, even biblically, you look at the Bible, it says Jesus asked people to come to him like children. I mean, open, you know, peaceful, just come. And it's very interesting how, as you're mentioning this topic, the one thing that continued coming to me was that all the really successful companies that I work with, especially like Dyn and others, they provide and they breathe that environment of decreasing stress and increasing innovation by promoting play.
And yet we look at that, Peter, and we're like, what are those people doing? You know, they don't look productive.
Exactly. It's like, it's brilliant. I mean, it's truly brilliant. And it's getting back to where we come from, as opposed to, you know, pushing so hard of a regimen of making sure that people work like thoroughbreds, which decreases productivity. It actually produces just work, but it doesn't increase innovation. And what we're trying to do is increase innovation as a country, as opposed to just pushing, you know, work, work, work. There's a difference.
Oh,
innovation,
Peter,
creates jobs.
Thank you so much.
Focusing on work decreases.
Thank you so much for calling in. And there's so much there, Stephen. I remember a couple years ago, we as a family visited a relative who worked at Google. And, you know, there are people playing volleyball. There are people juggling. You know, people just out in the courtyards of Google doing all sorts of things. And my kids thought, wow, I want to work here. Look at,
yeah,
they just play all day. I said, no, I think they work pretty hard here, too. Otherwise, they wouldn't be as successful. But I think Peter's really kind of hitting on something. Maybe even a message to employers.
Well, I think sometimes people misunderstand what's going on at companies like Google, where they see the volleyball courts and the, you know, foosball tables, and they think, oh, this is the perk. This is how they attract talented people,
right?
So that they can
make
be such
fun.
An incredibly successful company. They get them, you know, they give them these playful things and the masseuse and all the great food and everything so that they can attract great talent. But in fact, I think the reason they are so successful is in part because they have had that environment from almost from the beginning, that they have recognized that, as a caller said, when you're in that kind of stress state, that is a focus on one thing, get this problem solved kind of state. It would be useful sometimes. There is a reason why the brain kind of kicks into gear that way when you are stressed. But if you are trying to be creative, that is the associative, connective, kind of lateral thinking like state. And that one gets into that state by being relaxed and open to new experiences. And that is what the kind of the playful mind is best at. So if you create a work environment that values that particular mindset, it may look like it's just a perk, but actually it's a big part of the kind of corporate identity.
Okay, so the flip side of that, and let me just try this out on you, Stephen, okay? So we're all on board with that analogy, you know, play fosters creativity, and companies that can incorporate, you know, downtime or fun time may see a more innovative response from their employees. But thinking about Japan now in the 1970s and 80s, you know, that was a real center of innovation. You know, the cars that just took American automakers by storm, the radios and Sony and the Walkman. And yet we don't think of Japan as a very playful culture. We think of it as a sort of nose to the grindstone culture. So I just wonder what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know enough about Japan in that period. I wonder if it didn't feel relative to where it had been recovering from World War II, you know, in the 50s and 60s, if it didn't in fact feel as though it were, you know, kind of relatively playful.
A little more relaxed.
I mean, if you go around, I was just in Tokyo last year, and if you go now, Tokyo, you know, for instance, feels like an incredibly playful culture in a sense. You know, there's just teeming with the hipster kids roaming around the streets and crazy fashions and all that kind of stuff. And so I suspect you would have seen some of that. I mean, I agree that was not what some of those, there was certainly a model, particularly with the cars, of kind of efficiency and quality, less kind of innovation and creativity and play. On the technology side, you know, in terms of like the Walkman, that is actually closer to the kind of innovation that we would associate with, say, you know, kind of California tech companies. That would be an interesting case study. I'll have to go research that.
Well, and so here's the other question coming out of that. And if that's the topic of your next book, you can thank me. Mm-hmm. Are there particular societies, Stephen, particular cultures that do seem to innovate over and over because of their predilection for play, their search for delight?
Well, there are periods, right, where there in various cultures. So, for instance, you know, there's so much interesting stuff happening in Baghdad. 1,000 years ago, it's a little bit longer than that, and partially is defining these places in that culture, physical places like the House of Wisdom or the salons in Paris in the 1700s, where those automated toys were displayed, or the coffee houses in London around that same period, where so many ideas in the culture came out of people just sitting around drinking coffee all day. Those periods, those moments in time in those cultures, because they have these kind of wonderland play spaces, they just again and again were driving the new ideas in the world out of those kind of leisure environments.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk more about play, wonder, delight, and how it leads to innovation. And, of course, we want your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More with Stephen Johnson in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how wonder and delight prompt us to innovate. We're talking with the author of a new book called Wonderland, Stephen Johnson. In addition to the book, he runs the podcast Wonderland. He's written 9 other books on history, creativity, and innovative thinking. He's the host of the PBS series How We Got to Now. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, questions, comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Stephen, let's go back to our listeners. Chris is joining us from Kittery, Maine. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Good morning, great subject. My thoughts on this is that, going back to childhood play is very incredibly important, of course. It leads to cooperation, it leads to teamwork. Teamwork leads to cooperation as an adult in armed forces, sports, companies, all sorts of walks of life, and in turn, cooperation leads to exploration. Now, as a dad, and you, I know you've got children, Laura, when your kids were younger, what were if you left a kid, especially a young kid, they'd disappear if you didn't keep your eye on them because they were gone exploring places. And that continues, that same thing, I think, is like, I don't know, it's like genetically imprinted in your brain, but it continues, and that's why with the great explorations, opened up the trade routes, opened up the spice routes. That's why it goes on to this day. That's why we strive to go into space, land man in the moon, because we want to explore all the time. And exploration leads to innovation in the reverse, because you can't explore unless you have got the tools to explore with.
Right. It's all one big circle.
I think, you know, and as a child, when you start playing with your friends, you get into the games, you organize, you get a game of pickup, baseball, whatever, you're on a ski team, your soccer team, football team at school. As you grow older, and then that leads into more adult corporations, you learn to be able to work with people. And if you're smart, you learn to be able to listen to other people's ideas.
Well, Chris, I'm glad you called because this raises an important question. So thank you so much. You know, he mentioned, Stephen, learning cooperation through play. They use the game, a pickup game of ball. You do hear that more kids these days don't do that type of just random, let's gather, let's figure this out, let's work it out, let's fight about the rules and then come up with a plan, that they're more content to just sit in a corner with their devices and play by themselves.
Right. Well, 2 points to be made there. So one very important point you allude to and that Chris alluded to, which is that one thing that's beautiful about the way that kids play is particularly before they're kind of taught officially how they're supposed to play, is that they spend a lot of time inventing the rules, right? They're kind of designing the game and then playing it. And that process of coming up with, you know, what should the rules be of this imaginary game that we're going to play, that's a very high-level form of thinking, right? You're thinking, what will make this entertaining? All right, if we make the rules this, you know, if the ball bounces off that side of the wall, then you get 2 points and the ball, you know. And you're making predictions about what will be fun, what will be interesting, will it be too challenging, will it be too easy for one side, you know, given these rules. And then you're constantly kind of tinkering with the rules to make the game more fun. And it's almost like the scientific method there. You're building a hypothesis about what will work, and then you test it by playing, and then you refine it, you know, based on what's going on. And that's a beautiful thing. In fact, I just spent a couple of months on and off with my youngest son, who's now 10. This is more when he was like 8 or 9, designing a board game together. And it's just a beautiful thing to do with your kid because, you know, playing a board game with a child is fun, but actually trying to come up with a new board game from scratch and thinking about, okay, what's the best mechanism? What's the metaphor of the game, you know? And then what should the gameplay be like? And, you know, is it a card game? Is it a dice-based game? What are the different kinds of strategies? And then you play it and you're like, okay, that's really boring. You know, it's really easy
you
to win.
You didn't say that, you know, did you?
and then you're like, okay, how can we make it more interesting?
Right.
And you think, well, if we change this one rule, and it's just, it's a very creative way of thinking, and you can do it with a five-year-old almost. I mean, kids get it very, very early
right.
on because, again, they have this kind of appetite for play. The question about devices and screens, you know, it really depends on what's going on those screens, right? I mean, when the kids are playing Minecraft, it's exactly that same idea, right? They're inventing, they're literally building a world. They're kind of changing the rules as they go. They're learning almost programming skills from exploring this world. And it's also true of any kind of simulation game, you know, the kind of family of games that goes back to SimCity and Civilization. And what's beautiful about those games is you're setting your own objectives, right? You can build any kind of city you want.
Right, and you have to make all sorts of choices that have consequences.
Yeah, you know, I want to build a city that's the most environmentally friendly city ever. I want to build the biggest city, or I want to build a city that has, you know, the tallest skyscrapers or whatever it is. And every time you play it, they're, you know, literally thousands of variables that you have to think about that are shifting in real time and influencing each other, and you're constantly kind of steering this very complicated system towards the objectives that you have set for yourself. And that is, you know, that is a very advanced form of cognition and problem solving and kind of goal definition. That's tremendous exercise for the brain. And increasingly, of course, these games are collaborative. The people may not be, you know, Minecraft, you're networked in, you're talking to lots of other people. You know, they may not be in the room with you, but they are, as Chris, the caller was talking about, they are very much about collaboration. The problem with them, and I wrestle with this every day as a parent of, you know, I've got now three kids, two of whom are teenagers, and the play state, the game world is so powerful that it's sometimes the only thing they want to do, right? You know, so it's not that there's something wrong. Even you know, some of these violent video games like Battlefield or something like that, they're very complicated. If you sit down with your kid and try and figure out what they are doing in the game and what they are keeping track of, it's enormously rich. It's not just running around shooting at things. There are all these other people in the world. There's a very complicated map. There are all these different objectives. They have to mentally register all these different things at the same time, and they're constantly shifting what the rules are and how they're interacting with these other players. So it's very powerful as a kind of form of mental exercise. It's also just so alluring that they get sucked into it and will happily do it for five straight hours. And so our job as parents, I think, is to say, we recognize that this is not a waste of your brain and you are doing cognitively rich things here. But you have to do some other things too. Like, you also have to have a passion for reading, and you have to go outside and run around and throw a ball with your friends and socialize and talk to people face to face. So it's getting the balance right. But it's important to recognize how much value is in those virtual spaces as well.
So it's not that the virtual spaces are bad, but your concern seems to be, Stephen, that they're so engaging that other types of play, including physical play, get ignored.
And that's right. And I think there is a sliding scale of kind of intellectual richness here. It's not that you need your kids only to be playing educational software. You know, to me, if your child is playing Civilization, for instance, where you're simulating the whole sweep of human history,
right?
That is, in some ways, is intellectually rich as anything that they're going to get in school. I mean, it's a very complicated game, and they have to, on a very high level, to succeed at it. And if they're playing Candy Crush, that's maybe not quite as intellectually rich, right? So it's not just is this video game time versus non-video game time, but what video game are you playing? And how complex is the world in that game? And if there is a lot of complexity there, then there's value. You just have to make sure they don't spend all day doing it.
Let's take another call. This is Christina in Lyman. Hi, Christina. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm thinking about back when you were talking about Google and how they had the volleyball and the foosball. And
right.
I've heard that they had slides in their office and that kind of thing. I'm wondering if maybe that is a way to get, you know, nowadays people that are in the tech world, I've noticed even with children these days playing their iPads a lot or on their phone a lot, it's kind of hard. It's harder for them to learn how to interact with others. I feel like they're lacking a lot of social skills, you know, especially people that are very innovative in that technical sense. So I wonder if maybe companies like Google have those things as a way to sort of push people together, to get people talking, to get people interacting. You know, it's like Chris or Stephen was just saying, you know, his kids need to not just play on their phone or play games, but also get out there and do other things. Is maybe that's possibly what Google is thinking, you know, and I think that's a really great way, because if you have a company where everybody's sitting at their desks or sitting in their offices or their cubicles and not interacting, and maybe they don't want to interact, that's, you know, sort of a fun way to get people to almost be forced to to interact, to have fun.
Yeah, and on a physical, tactical level, Christina. So two types of creativity and both equally necessary. That's a really insightful point. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, that's a great point, and I'm sure that's partially true, that particularly in the engineering side, Google has, you know, such a big company, there are a lot of different divisions, but in the engineering side where all the programmers are, which is obviously a huge part of that organization, I think there is a tendency for folks to kind of just get locked into their screens and not have that face-to-face interaction with people, even if they're sitting right next to them, and so the foosball table becomes a way to bring people out of that. That's a really interesting idea. I actually went to gave a talk earlier this year at Zappos, and Zappos is, which is really a customer service company, right? Because it's about, you know, kind of they're famous for having such great customer service.
Online shoes,
whatever, when you call it, you know, online shoes
and other stuff.
And that place is the most playful organization I've ever seen in my life. It's like Burning Man there, full time or something, or Woodstock. I mean, it's just every, you know, the offices are crazy. Everybody has these themes in their offices, and all these, you know, some of them have been decked out to look like tropical rainforests, and people are encouraged to have these kind of different group identities, and the, you know, it's not just a foosball table, like the whole thing kind of feels like a theme park. And they, I don't know, they seem to do pretty well. But
yeah,
it's really striking when you go in and you're kind of used to what a normal corporate environment looks like. It is a completely different world there.
Here's a comment from Liz on Facebook. And thank you, Liz. She says, I'm wondering what Johnson might say about the overlap and differences between play and art making. Is the impulse to create art similar or different to the impulse to play? Liz, thank you so much. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I tried to... It's interesting. In the book, I have a chapter on music that's very important to the argument of the book. But I kind of separated out, for the most part, other forms of art in a sense that were largely kind of representational forms of art, right? So if you think about the novel, for instance, and narrative and stories, more generally, there is something a bit more kind of functional about a narrative or story, where you're kind of like, there's a moral to this story, or this is a lesson, or this is representational of somebody else's life, and I'm going to tell it to you. And so you can make the more of an argument that there's something utilitarian about that instinct to tell stories, for instance. Whereas music is one of the great mysteries of human history. It's ancient, right? I talk about these bone flutes that go back, you know, 40 or 50,000 years. And clearly music is a huge part of the love for music, a huge part of what it means to be human, and a tremendous amount of technological ingenuity has gone into creating musical instruments over the years. But it's unclear why we care so much about music. It's just kind of variations, these kind of waveforms, air molecules bouncing around in kind of mathematically interesting patterns. We don't know. It's not telling a representational story or showing us an image of something that we know in the world. It's just these abstract sounds. And yet we find it incredibly powerful and riveting and moving for some reason. It's great. I mean, there are whole books written on this question of why the connection between the mind and music. But that was the one form of art that I really kind of led into the book. There's also a little bit about kind of optical illusions that's in the book as well, that also connects to art. But I didn't push it all the way into the world of kind of narrative and novels, because that seemed to belong to a slightly more utilitarian side of what it means to be human.
Although you do mention somewhere in the book, and this relates to Liz's point as well, that even in, you know, archaeological digs going way, 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 way back, there are shell necklaces. You know, people, again, probably just scraping by every moment of the day in those early societies, but still finding the time to make something beautiful.
Yeah, just you're just trying to figure out a way to make some clothes and get enough food on in your stomach to survive, but then you're also like, I would also like jewelry. So that's a very, it's an old, old story. It's an old story.
Well, Liz, thank you so much. And last question for you, Stephen, please. So What's the message for all of us from this book? You know, you, me, everybody listening, especially maybe those so-called sandwich generation folks with jobs and kids and elderly parents. What's your message for them?
I think it's recognizing that the times we carve out for delight and wonder and play are not just nice and fun, but they have an important service in our kind of straight lives and our work lives. One of the common threads of all the people that have studied over the course of many books, looking at people who are unusually innovative, is that they have a lot of hobbies, right? They have a lot of side interests, and it's that the kind of having a diverse set of influences and passions and hobbies, even if they're not directly related to your day job, whatever your day job happens to be, all those interests lead you in the end to one, having more fun, but also being more creative and innovative in your work life.
Okay, so I'm hearing some New Year's resolutions coming up.
More
Find
hobbies.
A hobby, play more, go to the movies, do something.
Exactly.
Steve, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Stephen Johnson, author of the book and podcast Wonderland and 9 other books on history, creativity, innovative thinking. He's also host of the PBS series How We Got to Now. Remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Liz Torrey. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.